Hello, and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. This is episode 43 now, and the date today is Thursday, July 21st, 2016. And I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, and I'm on the line, on the landline, with the Warner, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan, in Bangkok. John, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Hope I sound all right, and I apologize again to our listeners for the Thai sound problems.
This is the last one from Thailand, right? And then you're heading back to the free world.
Yeah, we're going to do this show, and then I get a few hours of sleep and head off to the airport.
Mm. Are you looking forward to going back to Italy?
Yeah, actually. I mean, it's been fun here, but I'd like to go back to Italy and finish some things. And there's a book I'm writing that scares me and that I've been working on very slowly. Mm-hmm. And I know that for chaotic and cowardly people like me, the only thing that works is iron discipline. Mm-hmm. So last time I was in Turin, I let myself slump around the place. And this time it's going to be different. And there'll be an iron discipline there, and I'll finish the thing. And it feels like kind of a family memoir, and it feels like once I've finished that, then I will have shaken my fist pointlessly at the universe, which is what I was put here to do in the first place, and then I can die easy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've now kind of teased listeners here a bit. Is there anything more you can say about the book, or does that have to wait to not jinx it?
No, I'm not so much afraid of jinxing it. I'm just afraid that I won't do it right. It's difficult. I mean, anybody who's tried to write probably has encountered similar things, especially because I'm trying to write about a wretched family, if that's not redundant. And yet it was a wretched family that cracked each other up a lot of the time and that had a lot of fun. I remember my brother and me sitting there in the heat in the afternoons because we didn't have any friends, and watching some rerun of some cheesy old movie from what I guess now was the noir era, but all we knew was like nobody ever seemed to open any curtains, and they were always drinking something out of a funny-looking glass and saying mean things to each other. And we supplied some great dialogue to those films, and in our dweeby, lonely way, had real fun. And I have no trouble describing the horrors. I'm quite at home with them. But like my Uncle Fred, who's a big character in this thing, Uncle Fred is a born horror story. But my mother's loyalty was absolute, in fact. That was her philosophy. Loyalty is absolute, and Uncle Fred was her brother, and that was that. So he was dropped on us like a Thorazine-addled anvil. And I find that easy to describe, but I find it much harder to describe me and my brother watching a movie like Casablanca that we knew nothing about and asking each other, why is this supposed to be good? Isn't this stupid, him patronizing this black guy while the guy plays the piano and insults him? And why is this classic again? That's the part that's hard to do. The funny, easy parts of a family that's still going straight downhill.
Yeah. I mean, maybe just report it. I think of that scene in one of Lomonov's novels. I think it was his Butler's Story, where he talks about going to see these really bad think piece movies from the 70s, like All in All the movies, the Kennedy.
I remember that. Yeah. The Seduction of Joe Tynan, which was some thinly disguised Kennedy film. Mm-hmm. And Lomonov describes it, and you suddenly realize, yeah, it wasn't me. Those things were stupid.
Yeah.
That was a time when a kind of pampered stupidity ruled. And I remember that. I remember teaching Steinem essays and then thinking to myself, God, I don't think this will make people forget Voltaire. And yet, it was my job to show the rhetorical structure of the thing. And there's that old American proverb that I should probably put it on the first page of this book, because my family lived in its shadow. Like, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich?
Mm-hmm.
And that was an answer to everything.
I think that's Trump's motto.
Yeah.
Although he's probably not nearly as rich as he claims to be. I don't know if you watch at all. I mean, it's one of the nice things about being out of the country is you can filter a lot better all the crap that this country throws at you. The Republican convention, I don't know if you watched any of it. I mean, it's...
I heard Cruz didn't say the word Trump and that he barely made it out of the conference alive.
Yeah. That was an impressive moment all around, but by the standards of just utter trolls.
And the amazing thing is these were the people who were yelling Goldman Sachs. I mean,
yes.
there's levels of delusion here that are immensely complex, and we're going to be talking later about the Turkish polity, and it's good to remember things like Republican Trump fans yelling Goldman Sachs in genuine righteous rage at mm-hmm. Heidi Cruz, because real righteous rage and delusion and bigotry get so hopelessly mixed up and can be so easily exploited.
Well, especially when there's no left, really
right.
to speak of, except Sanders, who was a very polite, way too polite, and didn't seem to really want to win.
Right.
He kind of he's the closest thing there is to a left. I mean, those issues, there's nowhere else for these people to go. They've been completely
yep.
screwed by, the idea of putting Clinton back in, and Clinton is the one who really destroyed the left within the liberal, faction of America. The idea that they're putting him back in now is just the kind of the final insult. Where do they go? Now they have nothing left but a bunch of malice and... spite and anger. So,
and yet that spite and anger is mixed with absolutely clear-cut critique.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever remember, and maybe I missed something, but I don't ever remember Sanders saying with the same blunt rage what Trump said about the Iraq War. I don't remember anybody on the Democratic side saying
mm-hmm.
that. And the fact that it was left to Trump to say that as part of a factional war within the right was a really sad demonstration that, as you and I have been saying, and as you and I and Yasha and a lot of people were trying to work on it at the exile, there is no American left that knows how to stick a knife in somebody's throat.
Mm-hmm.
And for all our work and career self-destruction in trying to invent one, we were roundly vilified by our friends on the left, who have now blacklisted us very nicely for being rude or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, fuck them.
That's what they're good at, is
yep.
Policing their own side is pretty much it. There's no populist. I mean, again, Sanders is the closest thing to it, but he's an old man, and he's a senator, and he comports himself like a senator. He has fight in him. You saw it a little bit here and there, but again, nothing like Trump. He doesn't have that real deep populist, bone in his body. And populism is an old thing in America. This is what I don't get. It's not like populism is an alien ideology, like some of the European, like Marxism or something. It's a lot more alien. Populism, left populism, is an old ideology.
It's like specifically it's about 10 years old, as in playground talk. Like, I remember being around in 2004, George Bush has spent Vietnam with the Alabama Guard, is now slandering the record of John Kerry, not exactly a big hero of mine, but Kerry at least was in Vietnam. And all Kerry has to say is, "You miserable draft dodger, I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you?" And for reasons I swear to God I'll never understand, he didn't say that. He wanted to be above the fray or some
mm-hmm.
other phrase that makes absolutely no sense. Because this is a polity much like Turkey, that still believes very much in strength and believes in the direct punch to the face. I mean, actually, there are a lot of interesting parallels between Turkey and the United States. And I know these are all facile and dangerous, but when I was looking at the purges that Erdogan is in the process of making, they reminded me very much of growing up in Reagan's California, where the joy for his fans, and they are legion, is taking down those snotty intellectuals. I mean, he's gutting the universities, he's gutting the legal system, just as all Reagan's people wanted the Earl Warren legal mm-hmm. system completely gutted. Gutting everything that stinks, as they see it, of kind of noblesse oblige in favor of raw blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose a lot of being an American liberal or whatever they call themselves these days means a kind of snobbery that rejects raw blood. And I'm sorry to tell those people, America is a raw blood polity.
Politics is a raw blood sport.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. But what's at stake is not, I don't know, again, people, what do they think they're all in that Alan Alda film or something? Politics is about dividing up how wealth and power are apportioned.
Yeah.
And who wouldn't fight with blood for that? And this is the big whale, America. It's the big, like, yeah, you do have to fight for it. Labor unions used to have to fight hard and lost a lot of people. You know, most we don't even know were killed in
yeah.
order to gain some rights. I mean, when you reapportion, when you redistribute wealth and power, it's a bloody game. And yeah, no, the liberal left doesn't want to do that. I think they prefer purging fellow leftists because they know that it's less bloody. They can do it
yep.
more easily, and it's just less bloody and less frightening. But they do really fear populism. It's pretty clear the liberal establishment fears populism way too much.
Yeah, well, when you think about these people, I mean, I had to live through the whole PhD process at Berkeley, and over it struck me that, you know, a couple of years ago, these people would have been New England clergy. I mean, in the South, the clergy remains clergy, literally clergy. In the North, it went secular, but its activities, though they transferred to private colleges, are roughly the same and are overwhelmingly moral, and they inculcate this distaste for the blood sport you need to gain power. In fact, when you ask somebody on social media, well, okay, then what's your plan for getting power, you get no answer in my experience. No answer at all, because that's kind of an uncool question.
Yeah. Or they'll just say revolution. You know, some kind of vague term. Revolution, okay.
Yeah. I heard that in a Tracy Chapman song. She's got her millions. Why does she need to worry?
So, back to your point, and then I want to get to a couple of other coup things. But you're right. I mean, the Reagan reaction, the right reaction that really started against the liberal establishment that started in the 60s, started with Reagan in California, specifically against education and liberal judges, right? And
yeah.
So it is similar to Erdogan. I mean, I think you see this everywhere, but it started against the UC system. I mean, California had the greatest public school system probably in the world, from
yeah.
kindergarten through the higher education, with the university system, the state schools, the community colleges, and the population. I don't know, for some reason they didn't like it. Enough of them
they hated
it. I
grew up on a street with people who worked at the oil refinery in Martinez. They hated it. They hated the idea that it's really complicated, because my family was, although conservative, different kind of, you know, Jersey City Catholic conservative transplanted there. But these people who were like the children and grandchildren of Steinbeck's Jodes had moved radically to the right, and they hated the idea of middle-class kids having this sybaritic four-year interlude at Berkeley just over the hills, and not hiding their sexual and drug pleasures, having a good time and playing the aristocrat, but without the aristocrat's instinctive cunning and caution about hiding their pleasures. And that created a hostility that led directly to George Wallace stickers outside half the buildings on my street.
Yeah. And it's still happening today. I mean, Scott Walker, he was even bragging about it in the convention, but Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, again, he targeted sort of two main areas of the public sector unions, well, and the schools, the universities. And Wisconsin's another one of these states that has, and it always seems surprising to me, but, you know, it does have one of the best public education systems, including their you know, the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I mean, they're very well known, and he's targeted them and defunding the hell out of those schools.
Yeah,
went for it.
Yeah, the hatred was really complicated. And I've written before about growing up with those kids because there was this MGM program for kids who were considered very bright, and I knew these kids, but their family didn't feel too good about them being in this program, and a lot of them got the hell beat out of them for it. I mean, they really got the hell beat out of them for it. And by the time they had made it through high school, it had been pretty thoroughly beat out of them. And their plan was more to join the service. And I can think of one case now. This guy was phenomenally brilliant. Joined the service, and they put him on Thorazine, and that was the end of him. But their family didn't like them having been identified as possessing any unusual ability, and the idea that they would go on to Berkeley, even though you could get into Berkeley pretty easily at the time, was something that they weren't really allowed to consider. I mean, there's a lot of resentment here that and this does apply to Turkey, I think, in a lot of ways. A lot of resentment that has been boiling for a long time, and that is indifferent, for example, to financial scandal. Because one of the reasons that Erdogan in Turkey finally broke with Gulen, the cleric he'd been allied with till then, was that he thought Gulen was responsible for exposing this massive financial corruption that his Erdogan clan was involved with. I don't know if that's true or not, but the key point here is Erdogan's angry nationalist people didn't care. They didn't care if he was robbing them blind. They didn't care if he was living in a 600-room mansion. They kind of liked that. It was revenge. It was in your face to the more suave Istanbul urban cosmopolitan elite that had been ruling them for so long.
Yep. I think this is something lost on a lot of the snickering, sneery East Coast media on Trump. I mean, they find so many things on this guy. He's caught lying. He's caught, half of his business dealings were disasters and frauds, and they come out with it, and they think this is going to be the one that sinks him. Or, you know, Melania, his wife, had a couple paragraphs of her speech apparently it's pretty clear, directly lifted from Michelle Obama's speech in 2008, which to me says, that speaks pretty horribly about Michelle Obama, a very intelligent woman, that her speech was so platitudinous that the Trump people thought, you know, that this is something we would want Melania to say too, that it was so unthreatening and bland, but whatever. In any event, none of these things hurt him because, like you said, this is about revenge, and it's revenge on all the people that anybody who hates Trump. It's perfect. It's like, yes, this proves you're hurting. This proves the revenge is acting, is happening. These aren't the things that are going to sink Trump. And on that note, and we'll segue from this back to the Turkey coup. But I just wanted to bring up to you, I talked to you a little bit about this just before the show. There's two just kind of incredible articles. These people never went away. just in the last 2 days. So I think it was yesterday. There's an op-ed in the LA Times by our man James Kirchick. Now, it's James now, it's not Jamie. Jamie Kirchick, probably the most ridiculous and unintentionally comical of the neocons of the Bush era. And he comes out and says straight up, if Trump is elected, there will be a military coup. And he says it as a threat and almost as if he's going to lead it in uniform. I don't know how else to put. It's really it's a very bizarre piece, and it's kind of the culmination of all these neocons. And there's been a whole wave of these sort of neocon and liberal interventionist establishment people coming out and saying that democracy is not working because of Trump. But this is the first one that overtly says if Trump wins, it really means democracy is not working and there must be a coup. And, you know, the funny thing is these people blather about the fascism threat from Trump. But in fact, fascism was allowed to happen because the establishment at that time came to the conclusion that liberal democracy wasn't working. And so a lot of the wealthy people, particularly in Italy, but then in Germany and some other places, they decided we need people in uniforms to kind of put a lid on everything right now for a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jamie Kirchick is the perfect voice for this. I have a history with Jamie myself because when I was trying to pick for an article a while back, the three stupidest neocon articles I could think of, the first one, and it was no contest, was his article, Hail Mauritania, in which he picked Mauritania, one of the most depressing places in the world, and one of the world capitals for slavery. That's slavery and bride fattening farms are its main claim to fame. He described it as a beacon of Arab democracy, and whether, first of all, whether Mauritania is Arab or not depends on who you ask, and you're better off not asking. But Mauritania is not a beacon of anything. The French administration, when it ruled Mauritania, had a simple philosophy. Their slogan was, let us not hear from you. And because Mauritania had an election, Jamie Kirchick wrote about it as a beacon of democracy because he had this I don't know whether to call it touching or disingenuous neocon faith in the mechanism of elections in themselves. I mean, it depends on whether you think these people are stupid and evil, and with so many neocons, you can't tell where the stupid stops and the evil begins. But anyway, he said, there they had an election. Boom. 2 months after his article, there's a coup. The election is overturned. so much for Hail Mauritania. I mean, that's Jamie Kirchick. He was born to do comedy. And he just doesn't seem to know it. He seems to think he's a pundit, and he's a clown.
Yeah.
So the idea of him leading a coup is bizarre, but it does show the hatred that the neocon elite and the Republican elite in general, the Bush elite, feels for Trump's voters. It's like, don't you guys know your job is to be suckers? You're not going to be suckers for us anymore. And the second they realize they're not going to be suckers, they start writing unbelievable screeds about the people who used to be their favorite demographic. I mean, there were screeds in the National Review about Trump's voters as worthless oxycontin-snorting welfare cheats. And even in National Review, it was like, Why are you saying this about our people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is amazing. It's kind of weirdly fun to watch this party and these people implode. And I think what's setting off this latest round of thrombos, as Austin Powers, it was Trump came out and said in an interview that he's not sure that he thinks America should come to some of the NATO partners' aid basically said, I'm not sure that if Russia invades the Baltics that we necessarily need to go to war on their behalf. I'd have to look and see what they've really done for us. And, you know, the thing, and so this is in Washington and New York, is some proof of absolute perfidy. And so Jeffrey Goldberg today in The Atlantic published a piece that, this would be John Birch Society, like just invert what the John Birch Society, you know, used to write about John Kennedy, about him being a communist agent. What he writes here is, it's official, Hillary Clinton is running against Vladimir Putin. And this is Goldberg in The Atlantic. And what he's saying is Vladimir Putin, that Trump and the Trump team are mentoring candidates controlled by this evil Russian's inscrutable, devious sorcerer. And so that's how this campaign, that's how they're trying to frame the election choice. So the choice is really going to be between an alien Russian, Asiatic, Mongol sorcerer and a real American Hillary Clinton.
Did Jeffrey say who he's going to vote for? I can see him going either way.
I mean, we have to remember Jeffrey Goldberg he actually won awards for these. He published this big expose in 2002 claiming that Hezbollah had all of these, this whole underground black market network in America that was sucking money out of here. This is 2002, I think, and then using it to finance terrorism against Israel. And then he did another big piece, this is 2002, and this is when he was at the New Yorker, supposedly making the link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and he won all these journalism awards for it. It was completely debunked. But it was used by the Bush administration. Cheney cited it, James Woolsey, the former CIA guy, all these people cited it as reasons why we do need to invade Iraq. So this guy's a complete discredited hack. But of course, you know, if you're so smart, why aren't you doing cover pieces at the Atlantic Monthly?
There's been no penalty for any of them, and there will be no penalty. Whatsoever king may reign, I shall be vicar of Bray, sir. That's the slogan of the American punditry. I think the one shock they really had is when their base, for whom they had total contempt, voted for Trump, who's not a particularly enthusiastic neocon and not a particularly vocal interventionist. I mean, God knows what he'd really do. But they suddenly realized that their party was a very tiny one. There were a lot of angry reactionary nationalists, but there weren't many neocons out there in the world.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, in a sick way, you can now see the utility of the Obama Democrats not chasing all these neocons who screwed everything up royally into the sewers for good. You can see the utility of it because now they're really useful for Hillary and the Democrats. Yeah. I mean, they are.
Yeah. Now they're busy destroying their own party.
Yeah. Destroying their own party and backing her. I mean, Robert Kagan, I think, was featured anyway at some fundraiser recently for Hillary.
Wow.
They see her as the natural, sort of the next vessel. The best, and certainly the best vessel out there to carry on their ideas. I'm not sure that Hillary would necessarily hire them, but she wouldn't shun them. Trump clearly would shun them. I mean, I know from people in D.C. that these neocons, these guys who are all squealing, that they're all freaking out primarily because they have they're getting no signals whatsoever that they would be hired in a Trump administration.
Wow. As you used to quote Bush Sr., jobs, jobs, jobs. I mean, just about any American story, you can just recite that and understand it much better.
Yeah. Yep, so there might have to be a coup so that Jamie Kirchick can come back to power and tell us how great Mauritania is. I mean,
I would just love to see Jamie Kirchick giving a briefing to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on why they need to do a coup.
I like the idea of him in a big white uniform with, you know, big like shoulder epaulets and, you know, a huge TV like on the screen. Everybody, please remain calm. I am Field Marshal James Kirchick. I am in charge of the Committee for Safety and Public, you know, Interest.
that would be Erdogan called this coup a gift from God for him. That would be a gift from God for America if Jamie Curtis Kirchick could actually stage a coup. A Jamie Lee Curtis coup would be a lot more interesting.
Yes.
Jamie Kirchick, no.
No. So, yeah, so I guess we should use this to segue to the big coup, which happened right after the truck attack in Nice.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, we don't have to talk about that this show. I mean, the coup in Turkey, it was kind of amazing to watch and amazing to watch it fall apart, you know,
yeah,
so quickly. A lot of these military coups since the Cold War ended, the military coups often do seem to kind of fall apart. I mean, starting with the Soviet Union coup, that fell apart. The coup in Venezuela fell apart.
Yep.
Because he had popular backing, Chavez did.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's a lot easier once everybody's got a cell phone to get your people into the street. And it's not always easy to get your troops to fire on those people. There's a reason that regimes throughout history have hired resentful bumpkins from the countryside to run as the security force of the capital city, because they figured those guys would be willing to break heads. They don't care about the people on the streets. It's always been a problem. And the real trouble with the coup in Turkey is, who exactly were they supposed to bring out into the streets? I mean, the people who run the coup, that is the upper echelons of some parts of the Turkish military services. It's clear they hated Erdogan's boorish populace. And God knows I hate him too, if not quite for the same reasons. But who did the officer corps elite expect to come out in the city on their behalf? The people who rioted in favor of the park and got crushed by the police a few years ago? The people who have every reason to hate the Turkish military? They have no masses, and they've done their best to make sure they have no masses, whereas Erdogan does have a real populist mass that was willing to lie down in front of tanks.
Yeah, it was amazing how many of them came out, and that the whole country kind of, I mean, even the Kurdish party, I guess,
yeah,
they had no choice. You know, what were they going to do? Side with the military?
I mean, that's the thing. Like, what can you say? You can say, we hate Erdogan, but no, we're not going to back another coup by a corrupt military elite that's been taking our people to soundproof basements to be massacred for generations. I mean, this is something you and I have talked about many times over. I mean, the Cold War has not finished, and the Turkish military, with a lot of help from the U.S. Military and intelligence, has been fighting the Cold War on a number of fronts for decades, and a big part of that meant decapitating the leadership of the student left and the union left and a lot of other left, and encouraging the rise of Islamist parties. And when you do that decade after decade, it's insane to think that they're going to come into the streets in defense of a coup by that same military that's been assassinating them.
Yeah, the Cold War reshaped culture and politics, you know, all over the world in ways that it was sort of, you know, we had this Cold War for 50 years and then suddenly it just stopped.
Right.
And we thought, oh, okay, well, you know, all these... Suddenly it was like black and white television. Like, okay, now we moved into color television. There was no thought about it. It was like a little technological advance. It was just, there was no thought about what the Cold War really was outside of a few cliches about, you know, fears of nuclear war. It's strange to me. No one's really kind of, I haven't seen anybody really kind of grapple with how it completely rearranged and structured, you know, politics and culture around the world and in this country as well. Science is everything. And, you know, and then we just kind of figured, well, we moved into this new age where those old worries and problems were at the end of history, you know, aren't a problem anymore. But we don't even know. So what's this new age? It is leftover from the Cold War. There hasn't been a new a new kind of global binding idea, or I don't know, there haven't been like big new ideas that have kind of reshaped everything that I've seen. People are kind of looking back to previous ideas.
No. In Turkey especially, what you see is that a kind of sullen majority waited for a long time for all the glossy progressive ideas of the early 20th century to lose their gloss and to lose their strategic urgency, which was part of the Cold War. And when they lost that urgency, it was time for something that you can almost see in terms of physics. It was like the I don't know how much early 20th century Turkish history we need to do here. I mean, basically, the Ottoman Empire was decaying rapidly even before 1914. The Sultanate was replaced by a triumvirate, the three pashas, the Young Turks, who took over and were in many ways more radical than the Sultan, especially about the eradication of non-Muslim minorities in Turkey, allied with the Germans, lost and destroyed Ottoman Turkey. And the savior of Turkey, as it grew into a nation state after the war, from partition, which is what everybody on the Allied side had in mind for it, we're going to carve you up now that we've beaten you. The savior was Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, father of the Turks, and he was a secularist, probably an atheist at heart, but also a fierce Turkish ethnic nationalist, and he put the huge investment in Turkish Sunni Islam, because this was the capital of the caliphate. I mean, Constantinople, as it was then, was the home of the caliph. He put that into a sort of deep freeze, and that deep freeze was intensified by the Cold War, when he was he and the state he created were a big part of the U.S.-Soviet rivalry. But when all that ended and there was no more need to keep that in a deep freeze, you suddenly noticed that there had been this sullen majority all the time. I mean, again, it's useful to think about the U.S. Where did Ken Starr spend the hippie days, you know? Somewhere in Missouri, sort of percolating his life on a low burn. I mean, where did inland Turkey spend the secular era? It spent it waiting. I mean, Gulen, the former ally of Erdogan, had a really interesting typical biography. He comes from a northeastern Turkish town, not a Kurdish town, which is really important in that part of Turkey. His father was an imam. His mother was a secret Quran teacher. Those were very unfashionable things to be in the Turkey ruled by Atatürk and his descendants in the officer class. But they were deep, deep tendencies like Calvinism in the U.S. Suppose the U.S. lost a war and a military dictatorship declared Calvinism's the problem. You can't be Calvinist anymore. Calvinism would be driven underground, but there's no way it would cease to exist. And once the pressure was off, it would come back. And since the CIA had already decided that the Turkish left was the problem, not the Turkish right and Islamist groups, they suffered much less persecution during the Kemal's regime. They just endured quietly and came back to life.
Mm-hmm. So where do you want to start with this?
Well, let's talk about what
happened
first.
Or do you want to go back a little bit?
Yeah. Do you want to go back first, or you want to talk about the coup itself?
I mean, we could talk sort of vaguely about a little bit of the history here, because I think you're right, what you said, which the background to this really is which side is Turkey going to be on? Turkey is a key player. Turkey is strategically located for any wars that have to do with Europe. Turkey was on the Central Power side during World War I and lost all its empires and everything, and World War II remained neutral. So right. Where was Turkey going to be? And Turkey wound up, it was pretty obvious Turkey would be a natural Cold War ally of ours once, you know, after World War II, the world was going to be divided between, yeah. you know, pro and anti-communist. Because, as you said, they're a very secular state, and they were very anti-communist from the very beginning. Yeah. And, in fact, I was reading here, so in 1921, the entire leadership of the newly founded Communist Party in Turkey was taken out and assassinated and then killed around the country. So there's been that's an ongoing thing. But so right after World War II, we very quickly began to cultivate Turkey as sort of the southern part of containment of Russia. And one of our main assets, we started bringing, you know, their military people. So we have America has a long relationship with the Turkish military, and it really starts in earnest, you know, immediately after World War II.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean, Turkey's always been afraid of Russia. Mm-hmm. had to be rescued by Britain and France in the mid 19th century from a long series of losing wars against Russia. And the U.S. is now fervently anti-Russian or anti-Soviet. They were basically the same thing at the mid 20th century. So yeah, natural ally and long history of overthrowing, and assassinating troublesome leftists. So yeah, it fit in very nicely.
Right, and then one of our closest sort of allies' assets turns out to be this very dark figure, Alparslan Turks. I think I'm pronouncing it right, Alparslan Turks or Turks. He was a colonel in World War II. He rose up to colonel level. He was the contact person with the Nazis during World War II. Turkey was kind of trying to see which side, you know, they didn't want to choose, but right. people like Turks, you know, Turks was a hardcore pan-Turk-ish, you know, racial, I think he wrote some books. He was very into Mein Kampf. He had all these racial theories that the Turkish race is superior to all others. And we've talked about sort of pan-Turkism in the past when we talked about Azerbaijan and Turkey yeah. and Turkey in the Caucasus. So he's the founder of that ultra-nationalist party, which is still one of the largest parties in parliament. Which one is that again?
MHP.
MHP, yes.
Right.
Yes. And so
with their wonderful little youth wing, yes. Grey Wolf, which specializes in killing people in interesting ways.
Right. So in the late 40s and early 50s, when NATO was being set up, or the CIA is being set up, and the whole Cold War structure is being set up, he's one of our main assets, especially for these kind of programs that are generally just called the Gladio programs. And you know, it's kind of hard to separate the definite factual stuff about it from some of the conspiratorial stuff. I mean, it was a conspiracy. The idea was, and it made sense at the time, was that after what they saw in World War II, when the Nazis had held so much territory, and they figured, well, this might happen again with the Soviets. So the NATO countries, and really the intelligence agencies of some of the core NATO countries, decided what we need to do is create structures in advance for stay-behind armies in case the Soviets overrun any of these countries, these countries closer to the periphery of the Soviet Union. And so there were a lot of arms dumps, and there were people being trained with CIA and with special forces of NATO and the Brits in a lot of these countries, including Turkey. And Turkey, they wound up playing a pretty big role, as in places like Greece and Italy. These stay-behind forces over time wound up becoming, well, what do you do with these guys? I mean, first of all, they're secret. They're off books. Obviously, they have to be kept secret. Otherwise, if the Soviets were to invade, they would know the list and the names of the people in these stay-behind armies and where the dumps are. So there was a reason to keep it secret, but that also creates the potential for serious subversion and harm. And so you have these guys who are trained in subversion, trained right. in explosives, trained in terror, trained in psychological warfare in case the Soviets take over. And the Soviets don't take over, but what they do in some of these countries, definitely Italy, definitely Greece, and definitely Turkey, is they wind up becoming an almost autonomous deep state within a deep state force that can that can subvert democratically elected governments or create tension, enough tension in society through assassinations and bombs that it makes the population almost want a coup to come in and yes. rescue them.
Yeah, this strategy of tension that yes. they talk about defines all these countries in the 1970s, and it's a horrible strategy, even by irregular war standards, which are pretty horrific. It just means you cause maximum casualties in the most vulnerable places, in the bloodiest, most awful ways, and you make it completely unclear who's doing it, so that nobody knows who to trust, and they just want order at any price.
Right. And so in Turkey, one of the main guys, and this was Turks, this pan-Turkish, ultra-nationalist, founder of the MHP and the Grey Wolves offshoot. He was it's funny. I mean, even he was considered a little too volatile, even for our Gladio sort of partners there. So he helped participate in the 1960 coup. This was the first of the three Cold War coups in Turkey. He was one of the 30 or so officers that led it. And that was it was different from the one in 1980 and from the Erdogan coup in that this one specifically focused on the democratic leadership. I mean, they killed the prime minister who was overthrown and a bunch of I think they executed 400 or 500 people at that time. Whereas in 1980, and that coup, the leader of that coup, his name evades me right now, starts with an E, he was a general. He was the liaison to NATO. That one was more about mass purges and really of the left, targeting the left in 1980.
Yeah.
They arrested like 650,000 people.
Yeah, yeah. That was basically, we created the strategy of tension and we can end it now that you've let us into power. And they did. It was pretty monstrous. They just, boom, ended the chaos. And Turkey in the 1970s was a chaos with an unequal war of assassinations between left and right. You heard a lot, and I remember this in the U.S., you heard a lot more about assassinations by the Turkish left parties. But when you look at the casualty figures, which I've been doing lately, the Turkish right, the Grey Wolves, and other nationalist militias killed a lot more people during the 70s. And then there are these other bombings, strategy of tension stuff, where you bomb a railway station and nobody knows who did it. Suddenly in 1980, the culmination of any strategy of terror tension is stop complaining about terror, about democracy, and it will all stop. And boom, that's what they did. They put 650 people out of circulation.
650,000. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and they also instituted a bunch of harsh IMF austerity programs at that time.
Right.
IMF and the U.S. were backing them up, giving them loans, and in return they were slashing budgets, slashing public sector budgets, loosening, making the labor laws more flexible, as they like to call it in their jargon, which means, you know, easier to fire, easier to break the unions, and so on.
Right.
Yeah, so that was the coup in 1980.
Yeah, that was a monstrous coup. That was the size of it was incredible. I mean, the size of Erdogan's crackdown right now is shocking a lot of people, because the total number of purged and arrested is something like 50,000, last I heard. But in 1980, it was 650,000. Most of them were not killed, but a lot of them were handled very roughly. A lot of them were imprisoned, and the Turkish left in particular was gutted. And this is part of the Cold War strategy by the left and its local collaborators everywhere. You see this in so many countries. Like, it's the left that we're afraid of. And it seems to me they radically overestimated these people. And the right is a bunch of people that aren't too smart in the first place, and that respect private property, and basically they're kind of quaint, and we can handle them. And this happened over and over again.
Yeah, one thing I always found strange, and this may be for a topic for a different show, is the guy who tried assassinating Pope John Paul Mehmet Ali Akça, all right, Akça.
Akça, yeah, Akça. It's got Turkish.
He was a gray wolf. He was a gray wolf.
Yeah, he was a gray wolf. Yep, yep.
How does that make sense? I don't understand, except that, you know, in the whole, in the world of intelligence and fascism and mobs, you know, they all kind of use each other. But I don't understand how that makes any sense. Do you?
No. Well, John Paul II was an appealing conservative religious figure. They may have, maybe they were envious. maybe their brand of religious conservatism they saw at war with his, which tended to be influential a little north of Turkey. But other than that, I have no idea.
I mean, the one idea was that it was that the KGB, because Pope John Paul was going to be a problem for their hold on Poland.
Right.
And so when you don't want to leave footprint, you know, it's kind of like if you think that people were behind Lee Harvey Oswald, well, he had all this, you know, a whole trail showing them as a communist. So you wouldn't immediately point your finger at the right for doing that. And the same way, here you have a guy from the Grey Wolves. Well, you wouldn't think the KGB's fingerprints would be. That was a theory. But, you know, who the hell knows?
Yeah, I mean, that assassination I talked about in Cambodia last week was a classic example of why it's not easy to start psychoanalyzing the people they use, because the people they use are seriously messed up as a rule. Messed up in a way that makes them easy to control, but difficult to comprehend if you're assuming any kind of rational motive. I mean, this guy who assassinated a government critic in Cambodia was a former monk, former sharecropper, former village idiot in general, and claimed that this much richer guy in the capital owed him money. It doesn't make any kind of sense. And mm-hmm. you have to assume somebody either paid him or threatened him or told him some bizarre story that only a really messed up person like him would believe. Mm-hmm. But that can't be that difficult, you know. You get somebody like that and they're angry and they're confused and you put a gun in their hand and you say, this is the person who did it to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so getting back to the current coup.
Yeah, we've had a long series of military coups in Turkey. You talked about some of them. Turkey was born in a military coup. The Sultan was, Sultan and Caliph was deposed even before 1914. And then the pashas who defeated, who deposed him were deposed for picking the wrong side in the Great War. So there's always been this feeling that only the military has helped Turkey survive. And it's a very, I mean, I've run into Turkish nationalism. It's a scary thing. I mentioned once that I've written a lot of columns praising various military traditions, and I wrote one called Glory to the Turks, which I would now say tilted too strongly towards Turkish military history. But whenever I wrote something in praise of other little-known military traditions around the world, I always got letters which were, if anything, too polite. In response to that one, which I thought of as very flattering to Turkish military traditions, I got, how dare you not mention Battle X, which happened in 1379.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're doing here. You're part of the Greek lobby. That's why you purposely placed Regiment 13 on the left flank, when in fact it was the left central flank.
Yeah,
I have never encountered a reaction like that anywhere else.
I don't know what I mean. These are war nerds on another level. Very, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that, the letters that would pour into the sick section of the exile about it from. I mean, it's not even pedantry. It's I don't know.
No, these were people who would have killed me in a second if I'd been easier to find. I mean, you can sort of tell the people who say they'll kill you and the people who really would kill you. And these were people who would really kill me in a second. And I was astonished because I was writing in character as a mean inland dweeb at the time. And I insulted a lot of people who didn't deserve it. And here I was praising these Turkish military leaders, and they still wanted to kill me. So we're dealing with a wounded empire. I mean, we've talked before, I mean, in, recently in terms of the Khmer's, about a wounded empire. The Khmer ran most of Southeast Asia 700 years ago, and it's very difficult for a nationalist culture to come to grips with the loss of most of that territory. And the Ottoman Empire had been crumbling for a long time and then finally completely fell apart in 1918 and had to reinvent itself, and invented itself in a very weird way, which was expressed in a lot of things that hurt if you grow up. Like, suppose we didn't write in the Latin alphabet anymore. Suppose we had to write in the Arabic alphabet. I mean, they went through just the opposite, because Ataturk said religion and the Arab influence and all that has been stultifying us. They switched from writing Turkish in Arabic script to writing it in Latin script. And that may have been a good move or a bad move, I don't know. But it was a move that rankled and that really hurt. They stopped dressing in the fez, the red hat. They stopped dressing in Turkish clothes. They were ordered to dress like Europeans, and everybody
like Peter the Great.
Yes, like Peter the Great chopping off the boyar's beard. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's the kind of resentment that seems to be spitting on your whole culture in the name of remaking it in a new and stronger way. And it may work for a while. It may seem to change everything. But there is this conservation of mass. There is this thing that keeps reminding me of inland California. That, you kids are all out there taking your tops off and dancing to the electric guitar, but you don't realize how mad the people in the inland Nowhereville towns are while you do all this. They don't like it. And they're just waiting it out. They're waiting it out until it's their turn. And then as the left got decimated decade after decade, and the right and the Islamist factions got coddled and indulged, they realized there is a way for all this inland reactionary anger that will not be stomped on so directly, that will not lead so directly to our assassination. And it grew more and more powerful.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to just go slightly off topic back to that Warnard article, because I'm remembering one of the things from that Warnard piece, Glory to the Turks, that I still remember was your description of the Turkish fighters who were our allies in the Korean War, and apparently and one of the best fighters on the
one of the best contingents.
Yes.
I mean, many Americans, many British, many other POWs basically took 2 days of beatings and no sleep before they started reciting glory to the North Korean People's Republic. That did not happen with the Turkish contingent. That happened to one Turk, and he was quietly welcomed back into the barracks and immediately strangled by all the other Turks. I mean, they were not fucking around.
And I remember your description of the Turkish fighters talking in the Korean War, talking about how they used bayonets and why they were so much better at bayoneting than anybody else.
Yeah. It was something that the culture had prided itself on for a long time, and suddenly through a series of strategic disastrous mistakes, it had no outlet in the culture, and all this Turkish machismo, which is matched by very few other machismos in the world, had an outlet and gloried in it. And this is something you see in the Turkish accounts of World War One. Even though it was a losing effort, it was a glorious effort. I mean, Atatürk, who was a great figure by any standard, first became a national hero at Gallipoli, and he made a speech that is still treasured by all patriotic Turks, and it was very simple. He said, "Turkish soldiers, I do not call you here to fight. I call you here to die." Mm-hmm. That was it.
Hell, just go, if I was 18, out there, I'd be like, yes, this is it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to just quote, I found your the Warner Beast. I'm just going to quote this one part here about the fighting in Korea. Speaking of the Turkish contingent in the Korean War, was famous for courage and loyalty. They never ran, even when overwhelmed by North Korean or Chinese mass attack. They were proud of their close-in fighting skills, especially their bayonet work. I remember an interview with a Turkish officer in Korea who was explaining that Turkish bayonets were superior because they're grooved, so blood and air escape from the wound they make, so they don't get stuck in the torso the way American bayonets did. And it always stuck with me.
This is the Turkish military, which saw itself as the only force that had brought the country into being. I mean, Turkey was destroyed in 1918, totally destroyed. And the Greeks had every intention of taking the western half of it, and the British, French, and other allies of divvying it up with giving the Russians as little as possible and making it into a slave state. Atatürk found the toughest and the best officers and enlisted men in what remained of the Ottoman army, turned them into a fighting force, crushed the Greeks. I mean, I recently toured the Athens Military Museum, and there are many proud rooms in it, but the room that describes their war against Atatürk's forces in 1919 to 1923 is a very painful and a very small one, and the one that sort of sums up the very little they have to say is a painting called "We Are Not Defeated." And whenever you see a painting called "We Are Not Defeated," it's like "Punk's Not Dead." It means, yeah, we were defeated, Punk's dead.
And they did get, and but it's what I don't get is, so the Ottoman Empire, I mean, it collapsed because it was dying anyway, and it had hitched their wagon to the losing side. So that would just sort of hasten the final collapse. But Turkey itself, I mean, like you said, they won. They decimated the Allies and the Brits, and Winston Churchill in particular, in the Battle of Gallipoli. That was one of the most lopsided, you know, military victories that the Central Powers had, that, and I guess, you know, some of the early campaigns against the Russians. Absolutely lopsided. But this wasn't the Germans, this was the Turks. And it's hard to square how they lost everything, and yet they seem to have won a lot on the battlefield.
They won in the West. They lost badly to the Russians eventually. Mm-hmm. One of the three pashas, I forget which one, Enver, Talat, the other one, decided to take over command at a key battle against the Russian army, and just was slaughtered. And part of the reason for the unbelievable cruelty to the Armenian minority in the Northeast is that they were seen as spies and collaborators with the Russians because they were co-religionists. And since the Turks had lost to the Russians on the battlefield, they took it out on the Armenian civilians.
Mm-hmm. Which, as you said, genocides and mass murders are features of a losing war.
From Andersonville to Auschwitz or wherever, they usually happen as empires start to realize it's not going well.
Or even little caliphates when they start losing.
Islamic State is killing everybody they can now. Like, it's your fault. Yeah.
So getting back to the coup again. So, I mean, Erdogan came to power when in early 2000s. Was it 99 or was it early 2000s? He came to, I mean, it was 2002. He came to power in, with this moderate Islamist party with the help of Gulen, who's now his kind of, Gulen is now sort of serves as his like Goldstein in, from 1980. Wasn't that Goldstein was his name in 1984?
Yeah, yeah. He gets compared a lot to Trotsky as he served Stalin. He's right. The enemy they love to hate. I mean, a lot of the real opposition to Erdogan seems to be the old Kemalist, we know best theory of the Turkish officer class, but they'd rather blame Gulen because Gulen is a former ally of Erdogan and he knows where the bodies are buried, or more like it, he knows where the money is deposited. And he, too, claims to be a defender of Islam, and he, too, has a strong organization in all the security services. So it's easier to blame him than to blame the whole officer class that despises these Islamist hicks. And I honestly don't know how deeply Gulen is involved. I mean, he lives in the Poconos. I mean, you know the East better than I do, but I gather the Poconos is where you go when you want to retire in comfort. And he lives in a big house there, and he's old, and he has a big network in Turkey, but it mainly runs charter schools, and he also runs charter schools in the U.S., and his take on Islam is very un-Wahhabi, very un-activist, very introspective and do-goodery. So it's a little
very pro-business, pro-Western, pro-free markets. It's the kind of thing we would want. And but the question is, does he really have this power and influence?
No, not in the current top echelons of the Turkish armed forces. In fact, nobody in the top echelon of the Turkish armed forces was. I don't know what they were thinking. It's one of those things that really doesn't make any sense at all. If you're going to run a coup, you either have to kill everybody on the other side who comes into the street, or you have to send your own people into the street. They had no people of their own to send into the streets. I mean, the people who were willing to die and fight the police to protect those trees in Istanbul, we're not going to come out to protect the Turkish Air Force brass. They hate each other. And the ordinary Turkish conscript is not going to fire a tank machine gun into a crowd of people waving Turkish flags. It just wasn't going to happen. Their only chance was to cut off all mass communications, and that gets harder every year. There's a really interesting cyber warfare specialist here in Bangkok whom I met recently, who calls himself the Grook, and he wrote a good article on what the coup did wrong, comparing it to a successful coup here in Thailand in 2006. And he said the only way you really could have controlled social media, where Erdogan went on everybody's phone with his voice and face live, the only way you could have hoped to control that is to absolutely shut down power in the capital. And he said this happened in 2006 in Thailand. And he said something that really resonates with me right now, which is, if you've ever spent a night with no AC or light in Bangkok, you know it's not a lot of fun. But that's what they did. They cut the power completely, so that people were literally sweating it out in Bangkok. Well, they woke up to find the tanks in the street, and since most of their phones were dead, they had no way to organize. And they also were dealing with basically a fight between the Thai army and the Thai police, and nobody felt any particular religious or ethnic or regional loyalty either way. It was just two guilds that were fighting each other. And that wasn't going to happen in Turkey. Erdogan has a genuine consistency. They genuinely love him. They call him the chief, and they do it in all caps most of the time. They see him as standing up to the snotty Americans, the cunning Israelis, the enemies of Islam all over the world. I mean, I have a lot of friends from Najran on Facebook who speak very slangy North American English, and they all posted pictures of Erdogan saying, "We got your back, bro," and all this, and that's their only reference to the coup. The idea that, you know, this is just another authoritarian reactionary generalissimo is not something that occurs to him. To them, he's pious. His enemies don't seem as pious. He's a former jock, a man of the people, popular with the lower middle class. His enemies seem like, you know, Fort Bragg trained technocratic snobs, and they hate them. I mean, his constituency is real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have. I guess one has to imagine that the military is the entitled class. They're the ones who have felt that this is their republic, their country. They established it, they protected it, they saved it. They feel entitled to it, and they saw that they were losing their grip. That layer was losing their grip, and especially with the end of the Cold War, America put also sort of less resources into propping up and empowering just that particular class. It just you know, got more more easily distracted at that point. And so from the general population's point of view, they're like the what they call here the Acela Corridor, which is, you know, the Washington D.C. the Acela, right, which is the high speed train for the rich people that goes from D.C. to New York to Boston. That's kind of what the military brass is there in Turkey, right?
And the shocked Brexit reaction in Britain. That was something that could not happen. I mean, the dumb people would sooner or later come in line and not do something so foolish. Well, they did. Trump is real. Brexit is real. Erdogan is real. A massive, angry lower middle class is real in all these places.
Bibi Netanyahu is real. I mean, it's,
Netanyahu is absolutely real. I mean, they talk about him in terms of very similar to the way they talk about Netanyahu. They call him the king of Israel, you know, and they call Erdogan the chief, and they see all these people as standing up to a sort of snooty technocratic class that has lorded over them and ignored their privation, such as it is, for decades. And I don't see any way that that's going to stop. I mean, somebody said, if only, on my Facebook page, somebody said, if only those Turkish Air Force jets that were following Erdogan's airliner, which apparently they were for a while, had the guts to launch a couple of air-to-air missiles and bring him down. No. Erdogan is not alone, and he's not irreplaceable. That kills him. That makes him a martyr. And then you've got a massive, wounded Turkish lower middle class that would go to war to take revenge for what had happened. And the worst of it is it would win, and whoever it put in place would make Erdogan look like a squeamish liberal.
Like maybe his previous prime minister, who sounded a lot like Turks.
Yeah, Davutoglu.
Yeah, Davutoglu.
Who ended up way too sane for Erdogan and kept saying, "Look, you know, we can talk to these guys. We can talk to them." And Erdogan is saying, "No, I'm not popular because I talk to people. I'm popular because I piss people off."
Why didn't they shoot him down? I mean, why would you have a coup but not shoot down the plane? I mean, there's clearly like some confusion there. It suggests maybe that they thought they would be, that they had deluded themselves into believing that there would be more support spontaneously or something, or that there would not be so much support for Erdogan. I mean, that skittishness, again, it really reminds me of the 1991 Soviet coup.
Very, very, very much. This is the coup it reminds me of most of all, because these are people who have lost their faith. It reminds me of some vampire movie where Roddy McDowall holds up a crucifix and the vampire grabs it, crushes it, and says, "You have to actually believe."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the Kemalists really believe anymore. I think all those glossy early 20th century ideas have faded and have been seen as the co-opted property of Western elites. And all the real faith, all the willingness to lie down under the tanks is with the pious lower middle class now. And, I mean, were they willing to give the order to kill the prime minister? Were the pilots in those planes willing to, you know, hit the red button and launch? I just don't believe it. I mean, when you bring up the Russian example, those people knew they were doomed and they launched a coup, and then the best thing they could think of to do was break open the vodka and drink themselves into a stupor because they were too scared and confused to do anything else.
Yeah, and a few of them even ended it off with shooting themselves in the head. Yeah. Which was totally unnecessary, it turned out. I mean, they could have had careers as, you know, fake opposition people.
I think
the ones who didn't do that. But that was the surprising thing. I mean, they didn't have... Some of these guys knew that Gorbachev was going to start moving them out. It's kind of similar to, I think, the lower level, or a smaller amount of purge that Erdogan was planning against some of these top military brass, right? So they decided to move in haste and hadn't really thought that people would depose it. I think that just wasn't part of the calculus that people would oppose it, and they hadn't really thought about the possibility of having to order their troops to fire on people or to kill the leaders of the opposition. Yeah.
No, and really, they're lucky that they lost so quickly and decisively, because they would have run a country at civil war. They probably would have lost the civil war, and they would have inherited a Turkey which has some pretty grim prospects. I mean, the most immediate one is what happens with the air campaign against Islamic State now that Incirlik is under a flight ban and Turkish security forces have entered it looking for someone they consider responsible for participating in the coup against Erdogan. Supposedly, in fact, they refueled one of the F-16s that was pursuing him from Incirlik. It means that the border will be less tightly controlled. It means that MIT, which was loyal, the Turkish intelligence agency, which was loyal to Erdogan and tipped him off 6 hours early before the coup was supposed to go off, because it was supposed to go off at 3 a.m., and which is, you know, a traditional coup rush hour, and it went off more like at 9 p.m., which is just way too early, way too many people on the streets. You can't block the bridges when people are out on a Friday night having a good time. So MIT will get rewarded. MIT is a scary, scary thing close to ISI in Pakistan, and the part of the Turkish deep state most willing to make a deal with Islamic State and use them as proxies in Syria. So it's very bad news for any civilians who happen to be at their mercy. It's very bad news for the Turkish intelligentsia, which is now associated with failed militarists. It's really very bad news for the Turkish lower middle class itself, which is now doomed to somebody who thinks he can't lose. And, you know, those people tend to do well for a while and then crash and burn hard. So this is one of those things that can't be hurried and it can't be stopped. It's a real movement, and it will have to bash its head into a lot of walls before it wakes up at all.
Do you notice that Erdogan was lashing out at Sisi, the dictator, I guess, in Egypt right now? And I think that's kind of interesting, too, because, I mean, the difference is between the Egypt coup overthrowing the Muslim Brotherhood, the elected government there, and this coup, which was, I mean, you could see all the things they did wrong compared to Sisi. I mean, Sisi, before the coup overthrowing Morsi and the Islamic the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, they had this campaign where they had co-opted a lot of the urban middle class and the leftists who were and sort of nurtured their own grievances and anger against the Muslim Brotherhood and all the Hicks and all that stuff, right? So they kind of they first cultivated them, and at the head of this, it almost appeared, I know from people who were sort of following this more deeply in that whole movement, that it was that there was like this huge online petition So it also had this real gloss of very progressiveness. And it was like 30 million people signed it. And one of the leaders of this petition movement was sort of an anarchist leader in Egypt. And it was a youth group, anarchist left group. And they had sort of petitioned basically saying that Morsi's government was violating so much of the constitution that it was becoming illegitimate and they needed to be new elections. And then that wound up being just used by... Yep. By the military to do their coup, but it appeared to be at the head of it, and it was. I mean, they had cultivated and nurtured the middle class blue state anger and reaction against Morsi's people first.
That's a brilliant comparison. Actually, they did it perfectly, and they let all that redneck rage show up on camera and look really bad,
right.
And they gave them enough rope in the traditional manner. And that wasn't happening at all. I mean, Erdogan's people run a much tighter ship. They keep their really hard people under wraps. They don't do crude street violence the way Morsi's people were doing. And above all, whoever's behind the coup didn't give it time to for the rage to build. Unlike those Egyptian kids, the Turkish urban bohemian left and the security services are already blood enemies, and there's no way on earth that I can imagine them ever making common cause against anybody.
Right. Yeah, they have too much of a history. I guess one of the things that really helped with Sisi too is that everything was so new and revolutionary. I mean, they had just overthrown Mubarak, and in that sort of chaos, and the chaos of early democratic sort of government, you know, a lot more is possible. But Erdogan's had 15 years to consolidate and sort of purge and kind of restructure the political culture there.
Yeah, and most of those were very prosperous years for Turkey, too.
Mm-hmm.
They were golden years. I mean, it takes a while for people to realize that that's not going to happen anymore. The only sane thing to be done about this is nothing at all and let it unravel, because Erdogan doesn't, we're using Erdogan as a metonymy here, but there are a lot of people around him, and they don't seem smart enough to take it slow. They'll push this, they'll push it too far. There is a genuine big intelligentsia and a much braver one than we have in the U.S. And he'll push them hard. The tourist money will go away. The European Union will not admit them. Their Syrian complications will get nastier and nastier. It's not going to be a good decade coming up for Turkey, and it's going to be a hard lesson, but it's the only way that's going to help. I mean, what are you going to do? Send in the 82nd Airborne? That would be the one. If Erdogan thought that the coup was a gift from God, the 82nd Airborne landing to help the Turkish military would be like God himself intervening on Erdogan's side.
Which brings up, going back to the airbase, the question of nukes. So we first put the nukes in Turkey in 1961, after the first coup, incidentally. So after the first coup in 1960 was consolidated, we put the nukes in. That was why Khrushchev then, that apparently was one of the main reasons why Khrushchev wanted to put nukes into Cuba. And that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis the next year in 62. But our nukes are still there. And this is like, no one's talking. This is a base from which Islamic State, that we're bombing Islamic State, and we have something like 50 or 60 nukes that can be sort of, made to order, from small tactical ones to much larger, you know, nukes that can wipe out a city or something. A bunch of them stored in these sort of basement vaults on this base. It protected by a country that now blames us for attempting for the coup, that blames us for harboring in that base coup plotters, blames that base for helping fuel jets that maybe would have killed Erdogan. Why do we even have nukes there? I mean, what are they doing there?
Jobs. That's the only answer we're going to get out of this. I mean, there is no conceivable military purpose for any of that. Who are we going to use nukes on in that part of the world? I mean, if we wanted to nuke Islamic State, we could have vaporized Raqqa and Mosul long ago, but that wouldn't be the brightest move in the world. And there's no conceivable role for them in the kind of wars we actually fight, which are, you know, cheap, dark, and dangerous, irregular wars. But they're part of the JFK era Turkey U.S. alliance versus Russia, and I mean that went very deep. I remember an Ian Fleming novel in which he's in with the Turkish underworld, going through tunnels against the Russian embassy in Istanbul, and they end up blowing up the Russian embassy together, and all these Turkish underworld guys are really cool, and the British spies are really cool. And 1961, it was like the high point of U.S.-Turkish relations. There was all that goodwill over our shared bloodletting in the Korean War, and the sense that we were both modern countries in a place where modernism was not exactly rife, and all that has changed now, and there's no reason for any of the nukes to be there. I mean, that's the short answer. The nukes don't make any sense, but they're there because we're not going to let them get away from there, and it is dangerous that they're there. It makes no sense that they're there. They're going to stay there.
You know, there's also inertia might play some part of it. Like, if we pull them out, it may mean a whole series of potential scenarios that no one wants to deal with at all. I mean, it may be a signal to the Turks that we're downgrading the relationship, which may mean that they're going to buy some weapons from somebody else, and may mean this and that and the other, right? So maybe they just think, well, we don't want to give any signals, so we're going to symbolically keep these incredibly dangerous nukes right next to, you know, Islamic State and their MIT handlers. It's crazy. Yeah,
it's completely senseless, and it is going to take a long time to play out. And there might be some really dramatic things happening too, because the demographics of this are a lot trickier than they are in other places. There are upper middle class Turks who are fervently Islamist, but have a Western gloss to them. And such people are extremely valuable at moments like this and may end up doing some things that will surprise us. And there's no way it can be avoided. The worst of it is that Erdogan has just declared a 3-month state of martial law. And martial law, wherever you are, means free fire zone. And what this will mean for the Kurds in the southeast is slaughter. They've been slaughtering them already. But it's a perfect distraction, a gift from God, as I keep repeating. That's what he called it, and he was absolutely right. It's a gift from God for the Turkish military forces that are annihilating the Kurds in the southeast. Not that that will really do any good either, because there'll always be more Kurds and younger brothers and cousins with something to avenge. But it's going to be bad, and it's going to be bad for a long time.
Never let a crisis go to waste. That's the old neoliberal mantra. Milton Friedman, I think, popularized it maybe. You know, the idea when Pinochet did the coup, well, here's a crisis, don't let it go to waste. Let's completely restructure Chile. Shock therapy came out of this. When there's a crisis, then you can take advantage of it and apply shock therapy. The same with Yeltsin in the early 90s after the 93 uprising at the Russian White House, their parliament building, and he crushed it. Then they rammed through, you know, these really radical privatization programs after that. And we had martial law for about a month, I remember, after the...
Yeah.
I was there at the time.
I visited you there. I still remember the smoke marks on the White House.
Yeah. I remember at night you used to hear, at that time I was living pretty much more in the outskirts of Moscow in October of 1993. And I remember you would just hear, like in sort of like in a movie theater that has a really good speaker system, different areas you'd hear this like kind of automatic gunfire. In very three-dimensional sound, you know, like one place here, one was a little closer but to the left, and then one was like, you know, at 4 o'clock somewhere, and it would usually be in the middle of the night. A lot of that was used, I thought, to reorganize who was controlling Moscow, because before the attack on the White House in 93, the Parliament building, the Chechen mafia did control. I mean, certainly everyone was terrified of the Chechen gangsters and then some other gangsters from the Caucasus, but the Chechens above all. And the months after Yeltsin bombed the parliament and took it over, they really went to war and rearranged who controlled territory and businesses there. And a lot of people from the Caucasus got moved out or killed.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity for the MIT, for the Turkish Intelligence Service. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows how many people got killed or how they got killed, and a lot of people who need killing will get killed in funny ways that will be explained as part of the coup process, and a lot of nuisances will disappear. And it's a huge net gain for the militant faction of Erdogan's party and for the MIT. It's a huge loss for the Turkish Air Force and the remnants of the Kemalist officer elite. And in the long run, it's probably a huge loss for Turkey, too, and a huge loss for Syria. And it's damn hard to see anybody who benefits from it.
So the Russians... they're kind of enjoying it. I got an email from somebody who talked to some people in the Russian intelligence services, and it was more towards the question of because there's some theories going around that the CIA was behind all this, and you know, as you and I have said, but I just don't see the angle on that in this particular one.
It just doesn't work.
No, so they also don't see it now. They said they do see that there are people involved who did have ties, which is I'm sure true, had some kind of ties to to the Americans, which would be the case with military people, but they didn't see a coordinated CIA. Hand behind this coup. And they said that actually the way this thing is unfolding is, at least from the Russians' point of view, it's great because Erdogan is turning against all of his allies pretty much, or what the Russians would have seen as their opponents. So he's blaming America first and foremost. He's attacking Egypt. I don't know who else he's going after. But from the Russians' point of view, and the Russians don't like Turkey now, though they're starting to have their rapprochement again, this is a good thing. I was going to ask you though. I mean, you know, we noticed before the coup, we had even talked about when the Istanbul, the Islamic State attack on the Istanbul airport happened. We talked about how it came at a time of some really weird and major moves by Erdogan. So he had within 24, 48 hours before that attack, he had suddenly decided that Russia was friends and he apologized for shooting down the Sukhoi. And all was good now, and the Russians immediately said, "Okay, all's fine." And now he's actually saying that the pilot was a Gulenist, and then he also made
and Israel was friend too.
Yes, yes.
Russia and Israel, best buds.
Best buds.
I don't know
what
the problem was about. We've always been buddies. I don't know. Now that will change. Yeah, that's going to change in a big way because his new friends are the Turkish intelligence. Hardliners who alerted him to the coup and limited the possibility that it could have done any real harm. And they don't seem very interested in friendship with either of those people. I mean, Turkey will now go back hard into Syria. I don't see that any good will come of it, but I guarantee that a lot of mid-level intelligence officers do. It's the ISI idiocy. They always think they can control these people and use them to their own advantage, and it never works. But that's how it'll go now. And it'll be fine with Russia because the Turkey that will turn against them will be massively weakened with the loss of a lot of military talent that's been built up over decades. It will make Turkey much easier to infiltrate. It will ruin the Turkish economy. It will help to wreck Europe because the borders will become more unstable again. It basically, if you want chaos, and I think Russia is pretty much okay with chaos anywhere to the west, it's great.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what, you know, what would be in Turkey's interest here. I mean, if you look at what Erdogan has done, granted, politics is about increasing your power and decreasing your opponent's power, at a sort of, you know, primitive animal level, that's what it is. So I guess in that sense, Erdogan has been very successful, and there's a logic to it. But by involving himself, by sort of rearranging who his allies are and getting involved in the war in Syria, especially since Russia got involved and Assad has become stronger, certainly stabilized, and Islamic State, their cat's paw is now being declawed and, you know, almost through. I mean, their position looks horrible. What are they going to do now?
I don't know. I don't think he sees it that way. I think Erdogan is a hater, and his people are haters. And I think the analysts have a general tendency to underestimate haters. I grew up with haters. They're very familiar to me. Mm-hmm. And I think what he sees is a chance for vengeance. And he's been using words like vengeance over and over again. And he's been saying that now we take our revenge. And I guess there's some idea that people will say, oh, no, you shouldn't talk that way. But that's not what's been happening. They've been saying, yes, take your revenge.
Death penalty. Hey, my people are asking for it. I'm going to have to at least give them a shot. They want it. I can't go against the people. Yeah, that's in America. What can America say about the death penalty? You
know? Yeah. Sorry, we ran out of drugs the other day. Now we just sort of have to sort of push acid into their veins. But hey, it seems to work. I think that's his priority, and I think there's been a deep underestimation of the politics of anger and revenge all through this. And this is a license to kill and a license to take revenge. And I don't think he's too worried about global politics. He's worried about who's on the list, where do we find them, and which fingernail do we pull out first.
Yeah. And he'll probably try to keep the military that he doesn't trust as busy as possible in the Kurdish regions, right? Killing Kurds so you take care of two potential enemies by pitting them against each other and keeping them busy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be ugly there.
If you see it as an ugly scenario by a hater, it makes eminent sense.
Yeah.
If you see it as, you know, this premise that keeps coming up Anglophone analyses that everybody is an Enlightenment liberal, then of course it doesn't make sense. But how you can go on believing that is beyond me.
Well, especially now. I mean, the haters are winning everywhere. You know, the Cold War, I guess, kind of put a lid on it for a while.
You had to show a little self-control for a while, but no more. Woo!
The Trump thing. I mean, again, it's funny, you know, that this is, I think, the other neocon complaint. First of all, that the Hicks, the suckers, decided to abandon them for somebody else. That's their first complaint. But the other one is they're not hating the right people. They really want them to hate Russia. And, you know, God knows, I mean, there's nothing to love for an American, you know, nothing to particularly love about Russia. And Putin, he doesn't offer us some kind of different alternative vision of government that's much more benign and humanitarian, and, you know, but why hate him? He doesn't threaten.
Yeah.
He does not threaten us. And so they're trying to create this panic out of it. It's just not catching on that Putin is now somehow Putin in this, you know, rump weaker Russian state is 100 times more powerful in terms of subverting all the Western democracies and all the people. Is so much more powerful now than the Soviet Union ever was. He's the one that brought in these anti-immigrant right-wing parties in Europe. He's the one that you know, was behind Brexit. He's the one that's behind Trump. It's the most bizarre theater I've ever seen, you know.
Hey, but they got their revenge. They've banned the Russian athletes from the Olympics. Mm-hmm. That'll fix him. Yeah, the whole thing is bizarre. I mean, it's strange. I mean, you don't expect the level of stupidity that you keep seeing among American pundits. Like, is it so hard to understand that these people are not worried? I mean, are not happy about being penniless? Is it so hard to understand that they don't have any jobs and they can't afford to get their teeth fixed? Is it so hard to understand that that would make them a little angry, even if their anger is often, almost always, misdirected? And yet, they don't seem to get that. It must have something to do with Russia or somebody far away.
Yeah. And I can tell you, knowing some of these people, they really do believe that Putin is behind this.
Wow.
To them, it makes no other sense at all. They'll point to some, you know, YouTube videos on RT Russia Today as proof that it's somehow twisting the minds of...
Well, that's because, unlike me, they didn't have to go to Mexico City to get their teeth fixed so they didn't hurt all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, once you've done that a few times, Putin really doesn't seem like a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I don't believe Trump. I think if Trump comes to power, personally, he's going to be most likely as bloodthirsty as any president has been.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't even go against his general, you know, his policies.
Not at all. It's good TV. He's going to do good TV. Of course he's going to blow things up.
Yeah, the idea that there are a lot of sort of libertarian right-wingers who are behind him, they really think that he's going to be a non-interventionist. And some people on the left, it's really crazy, you know, because he throws them enough meat. I think what he might do, look, it makes sense. Why should America... First of all, why did we even bring the Baltic states in? I mean, was there a vote in this country that we should all die in order to protect Latvia? I don't remember that vote. And I know that the people behind expanding NATO, people like Bruce Jackson, these lobbyists, they were people who sat both in NATO on the lobby boards for expanding NATO, and then were executives in, you know, Lockheed Martin and Boeing and all the arms makers. It was just one racket like that. I certainly understand why the Baltic people would want to be in NATO, but why the hell should America, you know, it makes sense. Go travel across this country, get out of the Acela region or sort of the Bay Area and travel around and see how many people are willing to die and have their kids die when they can't even make their own bills and their kids are, you know, drowning in debt from crap higher education. Why they would want to die for the Baltics. You know?
And you got to remember that for the American pundit class, it is always 1939.
Yes, yes.
And what was the big political slogan in 1939, even or rather especially from communists? Do you want to die for Danzig, or as it is now, Gdansk? I mean, we're talking about the same part of the world. And the implied answer to that rhetorical question was, of course I don't want to die for Danzig. And yet it seems incomprehensible that the average American doesn't.
Yeah, no, and they wouldn't have. I mean, it did take us getting attacked by the Japanese, and Hitler's the one, you know, people forget. It was Hitler who declared war on us.
Yeah.
We didn't declare war on Hitler. That idiot declared war on us because he was an idiot.
You could always count on him to do the stupid thing, but
So a pretty grim, I mean, not like our other ones are,
particularly cheerful. Yeah, but I mean, there's something about this, or maybe it's that I have to get on a plane at 6 a.m. tomorrow. You just have to laugh. I mean, it cannot be stopped. It will go on for a long time. And buckle up.
Buckle up, boneheads.
You're going for a ride.
All right, on that note, have a good, safe flight back to Italy. And so the next show will be from Italy and...
in dulcet tones.
Yes. All right. Bye-bye, John.
Okay, bye, Mark.
kim nerede? Bekler sağlam beklerle. Maykay bende kafiyeler sapır sapır dökülür bu dilden. Hayır gelmez ki bitmiş dilden. Mikrofon bana emanet kimden? Yerden geçtim geçmem serden. Kaçmak isteyeceksin ama nereden? Benim adım Ayben korkun benden. Geriye dönen yok gidilen yerden. Mamal okumak isteyen yok. Senden sonra gelecek dertler. Benden dökülen yaraları toplar yerden. Yediğin goller fazla birden. Eksikleri toparlarsın içten değil. Bu söylediklerim en içten. Bayram değil neden öpten içten?
Sana kimler el verecek bilemem. Gözünün gördüğü yetecek. Herkese bak merkezi dolduran herkese er ya da geç verecektir evlere. Paraları satın alacaktır paraları. Yaraları deşin hadi paraları peşin. Durduk ortasında bu paralelin. Ölümüne uçacak helikopterin. Perspektiften görülen dost yalanmış insanlık suçu terörist. Masum gezen insan gibi her yerde pesimist. Düşünceler sarmış humanist. Tavrımızdan hiç hoş seda kalmamış. Sen sıvı halde kaldın ben improvize. Sen gaz oldun ben sofistike. Amerika savaş ister diye doldu bu sayfa. Arkamdaki tayfa. Deyyare misali havalarda. Risale kime gitmiş gerçeklerin hepsini ansiklopedide bulmak mümkün. Zannedenlere tarihi yazan insana sormalı bunları. Kalmamalı gerilerde gemilerdeki bekleyişin nedeni. Denizin yok olması. Kanlı etli yaprak donması. Yediren sonması gereken yegane kaktüs. Vaftiz edilmemiş insanların hepsine lanet yağdıran insanların hepsine lanet yağdırmayan insanlara lanet.
Şimdi bana bir bak lan. Benim mikrofonda ben ceza. Patlayan bir bomba anlat derdini lan. Bana bir bak beni bir gör. Beni bir duy beni bir dinle hisset al. İçine lan al içine lan. Şimdi bana bir bakınız akınız underground'ı kafaya takınız yakınız alevi biriniz her yeri. Mehmet Can'la ateşe verdik her geri. Bu merkezi bir sistem çamura gir ve pisten itte. Bana bak beni gör beni dinle. Kızlar çıldırmış erkekler baygın salgın hastalıksa rap yok bad trip. Bak şimdi anlat derdini lan anlat derdini. Patlayan bir bomba geldi mi? Kalk şimdi haksız kalk seni kalktız. Kalk şimdi practice zamanı kalk atsız. Sarsızsın arsız kalmışsın kansız. Olmazsın yansız sen olmuşsun hırsız. Şimdi bana bir bak lan. Hemen yeah. O mikrofonda ben ceza. Patlayan bir bomba anlat derdini lan. Freestyle ya şimdi beni bir dinle. Lost Forest Underground'da gel dinle. Ya hemen o mikrofonunu getir. Lan anlat derdini lan işte anlat derdini. Patlayan bir bomba geldi mi? Hemen o mikrofonda ceza. Tutmadan önce sana kafana kafana kafana kafana. Şimdi bana bir bak lan. Hemen o mikrofonda ben ceza. Patlayan bir bomba anlat derdini lan. Freestyle ya. Şimdi beni bir dinle. Lost Forest Underground'da gel dinle. Şimdi bana bir bak lan.